From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today is the New York primary. We'll tell you about a small victory for Republican ballot access, and we'll talk with a leader of the Congressional Black Caucus. Democracy Now! Catches up with Hillary Clinton in New York as she tries to sew a union label onto the Clinton administration. We'll talk with the president of the leading garment workers union and find out about a national campaign to target companies that use sweatshop labor.
Most of them, they're actually Latinos and Chinese. Many of the shops, the conditions are very bad. Many shops actually open in the basement, and the workers who are working in those shops, they have to work extremely long hours. Like, you know, for example, like this season, this is like a busy season, they work 10, 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week.
That and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, broadcasting from the studios of Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York, where today the primary is taking place. First, a small victory for democracy and a court decision increasing access to the ballot for Republican candidates. Before we turn to Brooklyn Congressmember Major Owens, let's go to Joe Connison, managing editor of the New York Observer, a weekly paper here in New York. His front page story today is entitled, "The Brave Judge Corman Ends the Democracy." Joe, why don't you tell us what this court decision is about?
We almost didn't have a Republican primary in New York State. Now, I suspect that most of the listeners to this radio network are not Republicans, but it's important that, you know, there ought to be a single standard for democracy in a multi-party country, a multi-party state, where it isn't made impossible for a candidate who wants to run in a particular party to get on the ballot unless they've been already approved by party leaders in a particular state, and that was the case in New York. New York's ballot access rules were so impossible to meet, as Judge Ed Corman found, that in essence the party leadership, meaning Senator D'Amato and Governor Pataki and their functionaries on the Republican State Committee, really controlled who could get on the ballot, and they were going to give it all to Bob Dole, which in turn was it was a bad thing for the Republican Party in general, because New York still controls 10% of the votes that you need to get the nomination. So this was a very large, unfair advantage to Dole from the beginning. And by deciding, by making the finding that he did and then being upheld in the Federal Court of Appeals, Judge Corman has prevented this from happening again. It's not that that their machinations didn't have an effect on this year's primary, because it did. You know, Dole is going to win, and maybe he would have won anyway, but they kind of made it much more unlikely to have any real campaign here. I mean, I'm sure everybody in New York has noticed that, unlike 92, when Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown and other people spent quite a bit of time campaigning here, Paul Tsongas, that the Republican candidates this year have not showed up here, basically. I mean, Dole was here the other day for a few minutes at a breakfast in Manhattan. He gave a very strange speech in which he said he wanted to be a plumber. He wanted to be our plumber. He said if you needed a plumber, you'd want an experienced plumber, and that's me. This is all about experience. But other than that bit of rhetoric, we haven't seen much of them this year. So that's what it's about. It's about really a court battle, which ended in, you know, us having a primary with three candidates and the prospect that the Republican Party's leaders will not be able to control the ballot access the way they have in the past.
You'd think that Bob Dole would remember a little of history and be a little hesitant to talk about himself as a plumber.
Well, that's actually the headline. I wrote a second headline for that story, and I couldn't get in because we have this great cartoon on the Jump page called Rumble in New York, and it shows sort of Bob Dole as Jackie Chan But I did say, weren't the Watergate burglars called the plumbers? And maybe that's some subliminal admission on his part. I don't know, but it was odd.
Joe Connison, thank you very much for joining us again. Joe Connison, managing editor of the weekly New York Observer here in New York. I'm Amy Goodman, and joining me in the studio here at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York for the coverage of the New York primary is Daily News columnist and Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Juan, welcome.
Good morning, Amy.
It's nice to see you here in New York since I've been spending a lot of time in Washington. Our next guest is, we are joined right now on the line by Brooklyn Congressmember Major Owens. He is the only librarian in Congress, and he has been there for quite a time now. And he joined with independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont, as well as a few others, to form the House Progressive Caucus. We hear members of the Progressive Caucus on Democracy Now! Every Wednesday, and occasionally, as you hear now, on Thursday. And we thought it would be interesting to get a perspective on the politics here in New York on this primary day from a Democrat, from an African-American congressman in Congress. And that is why we've invited on Major Owens, who, in addition to being a congressmember, also writes some rap. Welcome to Democracy Now!
How are you?
Good. I hope you're prepared for the end when we ask you for a bit of your rap.
Oh, no, I'm not, but I'll see if I can rise to the occasion.
You'll think of something. Well, on this primary day here in New York, why don't you give our listeners, listeners around the country, a thumbnail sketch of the atmosphere here in New York and how politics plays out in the Big Apple?
Well, it's going to be a bit anticlimactic after Dole's sweep of all the primaries on Tuesday. I'm interested in seeing what exactly the Buchanan vote is going to be. The word has gone out that the Christian right should switch to Dole, so Buchanan will not get as much of that vote. The Buchanan vote probably will be an indication of the most desperate Republicans there are, the working-class Republicans, the few that there are, and their willingness to vote for a candidate as a matter of protest against the kind of anxiety and insecurity that workers are experiencing. Buchanan, of course, is not the friend of the workers. He's just a guy who is perceptive enough to see that anxiety there and to take advantage of it, but he's certainly not the friend of the worker. He won't support an increase in the minimum wage. He won't try to stop his Republican colleagues in their onslaught against labor and working people, their attempt to cut back on OSHA and to wipe out the Labor Standards Act. All kinds of things are happening with respect to the attack on workers at Buchanan. Certainly it doesn't show any interest in, but I'm interested in seeing how many votes he gets from those discontented people who are there. I think you're probably going to have a low turnout because a large number of Republicans who may be discontented and upset and feeling anxieties probably just not bother to vote because the Republicans are totally irrelevant, they feel, to the question of addressing the question of work anxieties and the age of streamlining, downsizing, layoffs, and maximum profits by Wall Street. Dole certainly will not address it now that he doesn't have the danger of losing the primary looming before him with respect to Buchanan's rhetoric in the area of championing the poor American worker.
So, Congressman, you're discounting it all. You don't seem to be at all worried about in terms of Forbes' involvement or what kind of turnout he'll get today.
Forbes may get a respectable vote in terms of those people who just can't stomach Dole and see Buchanan's extremism, of course, as being totally out of the question. New York is not the place for a Buchanan in terms of his anti-Semitism and racism and anti-immigrant position. So you're only going to have the most desperate kinds of people who want to send a protest message with respect to their anxieties related to the job and the economy voting for Buchanan, because the Christian right has sent out instructions. We don't want to go with a loser. We want to go with Dole. Newt Gingrich has sent out instructions. We don't want to have Buchanan on the scene with highly visible extremism. Our extremism, we're going to spend a lot of time. Newt Gingrich's goal in the next few months is to try to create an image of moderate Republicanism. The extremism is a fact, but he wants that image that we're really not as extreme as we really are
to
be projected. And Buchanan messes that up because he's a highly visible right-wing extremism.
Let's talk about that for a minute, Congressman Owens, because it seems that what Pat Buchanan says is what the Republican legislators in Washington, including Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole, do. Now, a couple months ago, I was covering you on the steps of New York City Hall, where you were speaking out against welfare reform, what you call welfare repeal. Do you think that Patrick Buchanan is really an extremist in comparison to, say, Bob Dole when it comes to legislation?
No, he isn't. Gingrich and Dole are extremists. The Republican positions, the Republican ruling, the way they've ruled the 104th Congress has been extremist rule, and the welfare repeal is just one example of it. They do not only want to pretend that they are trimming the waste and streamlining the program for better administrative efficiency, they're going to wipe out the entitlement. It's almost gone because I think the president is going to capitulate and let the entitlement for aid to families with dependent children be taken away. And that is extreme. It is extreme to take away lunches from immigrant children. It's extreme to cut back on the school lunch program. It's extreme to cut the only federal aid to elementary and secondary education, the Title I program, by $1.1 billion, more than one-seventh of the total amount is cut. That extremism is going, and they are not backing away from their extremism here in Washington. They're just trying to create an image. They understand they're in trouble, and they want to spend a lot of time trying to change the image and make it appear that they're not extreme.
Well, it seems then that what we're talking here is about relative extremism. And in terms of the way that the Republican establishment in the last week seemed to unite and send a message out that that this is enough of this situation with Buchanan. Do you feel that to some extent, though, that the Buchanan candidacy, especially if it continues throughout the rest of the primaries, will in essence create an opening for the Republican Party to, in practice, produce an even more extreme program and, in essence, open the way for an even more conservative policy to be espoused?
Yeah, I see what you mean, but I think that they are not taking that approach. Well, you mean Buchanan is so far to the right until their extremism will be offered as moderation, you know?
Right.
That approach, I think they are afraid of that. Buchanan is so vocal and so visible until they'd like to see him silenced, and they'd like to not have the extremist agenda out there so obvious. They want to candy coat it, and he's an embarrassment. I hope that he stays in the race. God and American politics work in mysterious ways, and although we know he's not sincere about his concern for the American worker, he has forced Democrats to begin talking about the issues that relate to the economic injustices and dislocations in our society. Democrats have not been addressing that properly. Democrats have their own set of corporations that they bow down to, and they're happy about Wall Street making unlimited profits, while at the same time Wall Street forgets about workers and is wrecking the American economy because of the fact that they can conduct so many of their functions in another arena overseas and just destroy the. Actually, they're destroying their own consumer base, and they don't realize that, but it's going to be obvious pretty soon. So we hope that Buchanan stays in long enough to keep the dialogue going. We don't have a Democrat out there visible enough. Bernie Sanders and myself and the Progressive Caucus, we've introduced legislation to deal with these problems. We talk about it all the time, corporate welfare. Buchanan has even touched on that, and nobody else would touch that. We've talked about it, and we're always beating the drum down here, but we can't get the level of visibility that media star Patrick Buchanan can get. So we hope that he will be out there raising that flag so we can all take advantage of the fact that it at least makes us talk about what's important in this election.
We're talking with Brooklyn Congressmember Major Owens, who is a seven-termer in the U.S. Congress. Well, we'll see. Maybe we're being optimistic. You're with the Progressive Caucus and the Congressional Black Caucus, which have all been defunded. Where is the Congressional Black Caucus today?
Well, defunding not exactly the right way to put it. I won't try to explain the complexities of that. The Progressive Caucus never took a penny from official funds, so they couldn't be defunded. They were always just a low-key, fiercely independent operation. And both are healthy and well at this point. The Congressional Black Caucus was inconvenienced by the fact that you could not take money out of your members' account and pay your dues to provide for the running of the operation. We can support it in many other ways, and we do. So it's as healthy as it ever was in terms of being able to function. There's no curtailment of function. The problem is, where does it want to go and what does it want to do? We are strong in the area of we continue to produce an alternative budget. I'm the chairman of Congressional Black Caucus Alternative Budget Task Force, and we produced one last year in concert with the Progressive Caucus, where we produced it at the Black Caucus level, and they reviewed it at the last minute. We made changes. This year we're working together to produce a unified budget from the very beginning, and we want to go right into the appropriations process and the reconciliation process all together as a Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus. So we are out there offering the alternatives. We are the conscience of the Congress, which you know, has a real problem dealing with its conscience, certainly the conscience of the Democrats, and growing. We are bigger than the Blue Dog contingent. Our two contingents together make up larger numbers than the conservative Democrats, and we just have to keep pressing in the arena of the infighting for advantages and trying to get our message out and raise the level of courage among Democrats. They're
but
not
Congressman, can you point to any particular successes that you've had, given the fact that not only is the Congress firmly in the grip of conservative Republicans, but that the president is more often willing to compromise and to cede ground to those forces than not. Although, admittedly, with the recent budget, he stood firm. Can you point to any successes that this alliance of the Progressive Caucus and the Black Caucus have had in the recent sessions?
Well, we think it's very important the fact that we have stood so firm and pressed so hard on certain issues have led to a stalemate. At least we were afraid when the Gingrich forces came on with their bully tactics, shutting down the government and threatening default, and that we were afraid the White House was going to cave completely. And it took a lot of maneuvering behind the scenes to keep the pressure on the Democratic caucus of the Congress and make them keep the pressure on the White House to stand fast. And they stood fast long enough to see that the public was with them. So once the public, and of course we had a lot to do with educating the public as to the horror of the school lunch cuts and the environmental cuts and the assault on labor with respect to OSHA and the Labor Relations Board, and we a steady drumbeat back into our districts and drumbeat over the C-SPAN has raised the level of awareness to the point where the public opinion polls show that when people are asked the question, would you like a Democratic Congress or a Republican Congress next go round, we are 9 points ahead. The president, of course, is ahead in the polls, and once we were able to keep up the courage level to the point where the president held out until public opinion came to his rescue, then public opinion took over, and the White House stood fast.
Congressman Owens, we're going to have to wrap up. We have 30 seconds, but I was wondering if we can end on one of those raps that relieves your political frustrations.
I wish I'd known. I don't memorize them that much, but there's one that's very relevant. I wrote it several years ago when they were negotiating with George Bush at the White House. The Democrats and Congress was negotiating with the Republican president, and it became quite relevant when the tables were reversed. I wrote a rap called The Meeting of the Mob. In that great white D.C. mansion, there's a meeting of the mob, and the question on the table is, which beggars will they rob? There's a meeting of the mob. Now we'll never get a job. There's a meeting of the mob. And I went on to develop that. It is still very relevant.
Congressman Owens, we want to thank you very much for joining us. And when we have you back, we want to talk about what you've been doing around education, known as the Education Congressman in Congress. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national daily grassroots election show. Coming up next, the president of Unite and Democracy Now!'s chance to catch up with Hillary Clinton. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here in Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Joining me is my co-host Juan Gonzalez, a columnist with Daily News and author of Roll Down Your Window, Stories from a Forgotten America. He's also writing a new book now on Latinos in America. Well, yesterday, Democracy Now! Had a chance to catch up with Hillary Clinton. She came to New York to sew the first union label into a garment made by workers represented by UNITE, the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial, and Textile Employees. UNITE is the result of a July 95 merger of two of the nation's preeminent unions, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. As she stood there with the unions, we got a chance to ask her a question about the Clinton administration's stance on labor.
Mrs. Clinton, these unions are fiercely anti-NAFTA. They say it's anti-worker. How do you justify the Clinton administration's pro-NAFTA stance?
Oh, I think that everybody is in favor of free and fair trade, and I think that NAFTA is proving its worth. And the American worker, these women that you see here are as good as any workers in the world. And if we give them the chance, compete fairly, they will outdistance any competition. And that's what free and open and fair trade like NAFTA is all about.
But the problem is unions say that they can't compete when corporations go south of the border or abroad and they employ ununionized workers in very unsafe conditions. And these unions are, well, something we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But before we go to reaction to that comment, we're going to go to Jay Mazur, who is president of the newly formed UNITE, the two unions, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. And we're going to talk to him about his standing with Hillary Clinton yesterday and also what his union is all about. Jay Mazur.
Well, I think it's symbolic in that we're going to be sewing in the first union label of two unions, two great unions that were established in this country in the early 1900s, and that the first label was sewn in by Eleanor Roosevelt in 1933, and now 60 years later, the First Lady of the United States, who in the same vein, in the same history of fighting for working people and for children, is sewing in the first label of these two great unions.
Why did you decide to merge?
Well, I think it's the wave of the future. I think it strengthens our strengths and strengthens our weaknesses. It brings two unions together that are in similar industries with similar histories and backgrounds, and it was a natural thing to do.
Let me ask you something. With the First Lady being here representing the Clinton administration, they were very staunchly in favor of NAFTA. What was your feeling about NAFTA?
Well, we disagreed with the administration on NAFTA and on GATT, but there are so many other issues that we agree on that help preserve workers' jobs, like minimum wage, like OSHA, like maintaining standards, like enforcing labor laws. And so that while we've had our differences, we have more in common than we disagree about.
The issue of minimum wage, the Clinton administration has come out strongly in support of
That's
increasing
right.
the minimum wage. Right. But while the Democrats were in power in Congress, in fact, they didn't increase it in the last few years and have made it only an issue when the Republicans are in power, sort of using it as a battering ram to say, see, the Republicans won't do it. So what do you feel about the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans?
Well, first of all, I don't think what you said was correct. I think that the president has been in support of the minimum wage. I think there was a long agenda, and the agenda involving, I had spoken to the president when he first came into office, and he agreed, and so did Bob Reich, that the minimum wage had to be increased. And I think he's taken that position from the first day he got into office. I don't think there's been any disagreement between the trade union movement and myself and the president and his administration and the Secretary of Labor on the need to increase the minimum wage. This is not true of the Republicans. They have been against it from the very, very beginning, and we will continue to fight for it. We think it's absolutely necessary.
While the administration might have been for increasing it from the beginning, Congress, the Democrats, did not put it on the front burner from 92 to 94. Why do you think that was?
And I think they may have felt that they had more important issues to put on the burner. We disagreed with them. We felt it should have been put on the burner. And in the same way that we don't always agree with the President of the United States, we don't always agree with the Congress of the United States. But as between the Republicans and the Democrats and this administration and the Gingrich administration, there is no comparison. I mean, it's night and day. Gingrich would bring us back to the dark ages. And so we don't have very much difficulty. We see the light at the end of a tunnel.
We see Pat Buchanan very fiercely putting out an anti-corporate message, anti-NAFTA, anti-GATT. In fact, a number of union workers are for him. Do you think he's a pro-worker candidate?
Absolutely not. He's a demagogue. He tends to exploit issues which he feels workers. I mean, he's never been pro-worker. He's anti-worker. He's anti-labor. He's anti a lot of things. I think he's anti-Semitic. He's anti, I mean, he's a racist. I mean, you can quote me. I judge him by what he says and by what he does. And I think he's an opportunist looking for the weak points and taking advantage of workers' sensitivities and workers' hopes and aspirations. I think jobs are an issue in this country. Good jobs are an issue. Security is an issue. They're a real issue. Wages are an issue. And I think the president has to focus on that, and I think he will in this campaign.
Do you think the Democrats have to do some fierce examination of themselves and what they represent, that someone like Pat Buchanan could sound like he's more pro-worker than the Democrats?
Absolutely, I've said that. I mean, you know, but he doesn't deliver our message. We don't consider him the messenger for us. And I think when people understand what he stands for, they will not support him, and they haven't. You can see what's happened. He's on the down, you know, he's out of it. He will not survive this campaign.
Do you think NAFTA is a key issue, one of the greatest trade agreements that threaten workers' jobs here in this country?
I think it will always be an issue, but the question is what other things that we can do. I think the president has the opportunity to do a number of other things that will secure workers' jobs. As I said, minimum wage, OSHA, maintaining labor standards, doing a host health care, the kinds of things that, we're not a single-issue union. We're not a single-issue country. I think there are many issues, and I think on the broad issues, the president is with us.
On the issue of health care, while it failed what the Clinton administration put forward, President Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton, many feel that it failed because they didn't have a clear message. They weren't willing to go against the insurance industries.
I don't think that was the issue. I think the issue fundamentally was much too ambitious. I think it was ambitious. We supported single payer, which was a lot simpler. They thought that they could fashion something else, and I think, but their intentions were correct. We supported their efforts. We spent thousands of dollars and extraordinary efforts of trying to get it across. I think it was aborted by the Republicans, who don't want any kind of health care plan.
You think there's any hope for it in the near future, for some kind of health care package going through Congress?
Well, I think if we can maintain if we can get back the majority of the House and maintain Clinton in the White House, I think we'll come up with something.
Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News is pushing for labor unions to run a labor channel on television, that they would put aside some small percentage of interest on their pension plans or whatever, and actually have some kind of presence in telecommunications. What do you think of that idea?
Well, we think it's a good idea. I mean, we're exploring it. I'm on the Public Affairs Committee of the AFL-CIO under the new administration of John Sweeney, and that's being explored very seriously. But we've been looking at that for years. And it's not a new idea, but I think it's an idea whose time may have come.
Do you think it might happen? Are you actually looking into buying something?
No, I might. If you're interested in history, in 1947 or 48, around then, the ILG, the then ILG, had its own radio program called WFDR. The problem was that a year later, television came out, and we had to sell the station. So that getting on television, mass communication, our own ads, communicating is not new. I think the time has come for us to have our own vehicle. And that's being seriously considered.
Last question, and that's about pension funds of labor unions are enormous, and where they're invested make an enormous difference. And some have raised the issue, like Gonzalez of the Daily News, that it shouldn't be invested in corporations that are working against workers. Is it being raised right now, for example, by Unite, to see where your pension funds are being invested?
Absolutely. First of all, we have our own internal guidelines. We're very careful. We wouldn't, when it was South Africa, we wouldn't invest in South Africa. Whether it was the Sullivan principles, and we went beyond that. Domestically, we take the same position. Obviously, where there's a labor dispute, we don't get involved. Two, we are very conservative in our investment policy. But as to whether we can be as pure as Juan Gonzalez wants us to be, that's another matter. We're trustees, and we have an obligation to make sure that we return as much in those funds as we can. That's required under ERISA. It's required under good judgment if there was no ERISA. And so life is full of compromise. Obviously, we don't get involved. I don't have any Caterpillar stock. I didn't have stock in East. And I say the union didn't have stock in Eastern Airlines, either before or after. Where the company has a clear history of being anti-union, we do not invest in it. On the other hand, we can't be as pure as some people would like us to be, obviously because it conflicts with our ability to return maximum amount to the funds, which is required by law. So I think there is a balance to be had, and I think we've done very well.
And that was Jay Mazur. He is president of the newly united International Ladies Garment Workers Union and Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. They have formed in a new union called UNITE, the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial, and Textile Employees. I was talking to him yesterday in the showroom of Nicole Miller, where many Unite workers were gathered to meet Hillary Clinton as she first, kept us waiting for a little while as she learned in the back room how to use one of these sewing machines and then came out to sew in the first Unite label on some cloth. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. In a little while, we're going to be joined by two organizers, the national organizer for Unite. They're involved in a campaign to target companies that use sweatshop labor. And we're also going to be joined by a local organizer who is organizing in Brooklyn, organizing Asian garment workers to unionize. But right now, Juan Gonzalez, there's a lot to respond to, both in what Hillary Clinton had to say in response to how she justified the Clinton administration's pro-NAFTA stance there standing with unions that had fiercely fought it. What was your reaction to her response that free and fair trade is what we're about and these workers, and everyone applauded, can compete with anyone in the world?
Well, I was amazed, Amy, first of all, that when the First Lady responded to your question by saying that NAFTA is proving its worth. I don't know where she's been getting her information, but I know that the few reports that have been issued 2 years into NAFTA all show an incredible failure so far of this of the NAFTA treaty. There was a report that was issued by Public Citizen, NAFTA's Broken Promises, the Border Betrayed. There is another one that was issued by the Institute for Policy Studies, No Laughter in NAFTA, Mexico and the United States, 2 years afterwards. And I think that it's amazing how little attention, how much attention was given to the original treaty and how little attention has been given to the assessments that have now come in. And I think there's no way that the First Lady or President Clinton, if they were to remember the promises of the Clinton administration, for instance, that NAFTA would create 200,000 new jobs for the American economy in the first year, when the reality is that even the government figures indicate right now that 42,000 American jobs have been lost as a result of NAFTA, that the promises that all of this maquiladora development along the border would be dispersed throughout Mexico so you wouldn't have this concentration of factories and pollution and so forth. Well, since NAFTA, the maquiladora concentration has increased. It's gone from 546,000 jobs just before NAFTA was passed to 689,000. It's been over 20% increase in the number of maquiladoras jobs along the border. The pollution has increased substantially. The estimates now are that every day, 44 tons of hazardous waste produced by the maquila industries disappears. That it is neither brought back to the United States as it's supposed to or disposed properly of in Mexico. 44 tons a day of hazardous waste are disappearing, that no one knows where they're going at this stage. So this is the kind of situation that is – so I don't know how the First Lady can say that NAFTA has proven its worth.
Well, now, of course, since they staked their administration on passing NAFTA and spent millions of dollars paying off Congress members to vote for NAFTA, and it was still a very close vote, maybe it is a little obvious that she would answer the way she did. Mm-hmm. But what about Jay Mazur, who is head of Unite, saying that NAFTA was just one of a number of issues when I asked him how he could stand with the First Lady and the administration, considering what they had done around NAFTA?
Well, I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for Jay Mazur. I think that Unite is one of the more progressive unions within the AFL-CIO, and certainly their publicity campaign of late, their ads on television are some of the best stuff that the labor movement has done. But I think that there's no doubt that you cannot equate the issue of NAFTA with the minimum wage, with even striker replacement. Pat Buchanan is not getting all the success he's getting over an issue like the minimum wage or striker replacement. It's over this massive loss of jobs that the American working class is feeling as a result of the continued export of industry abroad. And I think that You can't equate these things. And I think that the reality is that the central issue confronting most American working people today is the tremendous insecurity that they feel about their jobs and their lives. And that NAFTA is a critical part of that. And I think that's so I think in that sense, Jay is trying to, in essence, not paper over, but doesn't really want to confront the fact that the labor movement has not held the Clinton administration responsible for delivering to Wall Street. I mean, the Clinton administration has delivered to corporate America the two most important questions that it was concerned about. One was NAFTA, and two was the telecommunications bill. The two most important economic issues that Wall Street was concerned about in the last few years, Clinton administration has given them. And I think that Jay doesn't want to confront the fact because he sees all the other, he sees the other side of the Republicans and feels that he's got no choice. So he's trying to paper over what are substantial differences.
You know, in a future show, we're going to be talking with a union activist who is calling on the AFL-CIO not to do the early endorsement of Clinton that they're doing, but to make demands and say Clinton has to agree to some of these demands. Do you think this is why labor is has been losing strength in this country, is people feel that they're not a powerful progressive voice?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a recent report that was put out by the Labor Research Associates, the Edifice Complex, and it was a study of the AFL-CIO. And in that report, Jonathan Tessini, who's also the president of the Writers Union, reports that labor PACs, labor political action committees, donated between 1979 and 1994 $239 million to candidates for federal office. $239 million, practically $10 million a year for 25 years to federal campaigns, mostly to Democrats. And he asks, what have they gotten for it? Can't even get a permanent replacement ban passed. Can't get an increase in the minimum wage. Can't get basic things and yet are contributing over $10 million a year to political candidates. So that I think something is wrong when you see that much money being given to these political campaigns. And that's only the direct contributions, not the soft costs, not the volunteers. So at some point, you got to ask, what are you getting for your money?
Juan, talking about money, let's go to two things that we asked Jay Mazur. And those were two thoughts of yours, two actions that you've been pushing for unions to take. One is a labor channel. And maybe you could explain to our listeners what that is. And the other is this idea of where pension funds, labor's pension funds, are being invested.
Right. Well, see, I think there's something very important that people have to understand. With the election of John Sweeney and Richard Trumka and Linda Chavez now to the new leadership of the AFL-CIO, the AFL-CIO is reassessing everything that it's been doing in the past, and it's created certain committees at the national level, one of which is a media committee that is exploring what the AFL can do differently in the coming years. So right now, this stuff is being reassessed, and I've had some discussions with some of the people who are on that committee, and one of the proposals that I raised some time back was the existence of an independent labor channel, whether it's on cable or broadcast by satellite, that where the labor movement could have a non-corporate oriented voice on all of the issues, whether it's to put up somebody like Michael Moore or some other great comedian up against Leno and Letterman at 11:30, have their own news programs, their own soaps, their own movies, and that when you think of the money that the organized labor movement has, for instance, the assessed value of the real estate of the national office buildings of these unions is over $300 million in Washington alone. The pension funds are trillions of dollars. And if a small portion of that was set aside to begin to provide the seed money for a national labor channel, there would be an alternate voice for labor throughout the country.
Juan, we're going to have to break for a minute, but then I want to come back and ask you about where pension funds of labor do invest. And then we're going to go to our two guests who are going to be talking about organizing at a national level, going after the corporations that use sweatshop labor, and at a local level here in New York. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez in the studio. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez in the studios of WBAI in New York, where the New York primary is taking place today. And that's why we're in New York. I just want to let people know, Juan was quoting a lot of studies that have come out on NAFTA and GATT, and also on the AFL-CIO called the Edifice Complex, to let you know where you can get them. The Edifice Complex, Rebuilding the American Labor Movement to Face the Global Economy, is put out by the Labor Research Association here in New York. Their telephone number is 212-714-1677. That's 212-714-1677. No Laughter in NAFTA, Mexico, and the United States 2 years after is put out by the Development Gap, IPS, that's the Institute for Policy Studies, and Pueblo. And you can get this by calling the Development Gap in Washington, D.C. Their number is 202-898-1566. That's 202-898-1566. And finally, Public Citizen's very comprehensive report on NAFTA, NAFTA's Broken Promises, The Border Portrayed, is put out by Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. And you can simply call information in Washington, D.C. to ask for Public Citizen's number and ask for that report. But the only way to deal with these issues is to be informed. And that's part of our job at Democracy Now! Is to ensure that you not only get information from us, but that you can get further information by calling the grassroots organizations that are working on these issues. Now, Juan, you talked about the Labor Channel, and then you also talked about where pension funds are invested. Now, you heard Jay Mazur, the president of Unite, saying, yes, we care about where these pension funds are invested. How much money are we talking about here?
We're talking about trillions, not billions, trillions of dollars. The California Retirement Teachers Association is probably the single most powerful group on Wall Street. And the reality is that there are trillions of dollars of workers' money being invested, some of them in the very companies that are helping to destroy the labor movement. Now, Jay mentioned a very important thing, the fiduciary responsibility of the trustees of these funds. But there have been many instances in the past when labor unions have taken political stands with their funds. The number one was the bailout of New York City in 1975, when the New York City pension the union pension funds lent millions and millions of dollars to the Municipal Assistance Corporation, a very risky investment to bail New York City out of its crisis. Another one that Jay did mention was the South Africa Divestment Fund. Another one, which many people don't know of, is that many union pension funds invest in Israeli bonds at lower returns than they would get in the normal market as a means of supporting the State of Israel. And there are numerous pension funds that do that. So that if it's possible for the labor movement to make political decisions, sometimes against the fiduciary interests of the membership, why can't they do it in something that would create an alternate media voice at a mass scale in the United States?
Is there any movement within labor that's organized around this issue?
Yes, there is. As I said, there's an AFL committee, but from what I understand, they're leaning right now to creating a new national radio program, which, as Jay said, they had back in the 1940s. So why go back? Although I'm not saying that a national radio program is not important. The cutting edge today in reaching masses of American people in a way that will grip them is to have an alternate TV presence. And I think that debate is still going on, and I hope that the committee of the AFL reaches a modernist solution.
Well, let's broaden our discussion here to include two more guests who are in our studios. We're joined by Jeff Hermanson, who is the director of national organizing for Unite. Unite, again, the new union, that is the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial and Textile Employees. And we're joined by Dunyoung Fung, who is director of the Campaign for Justice in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, where there are hundreds of sweatshops that particularly employ Asian workers. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't we begin with Jeff Hermanson? What is this national campaign that you're organizing right now?
Well, we've been fighting sweatshops for our entire history, 95 years, as the ILGWU and now as Unite. We are going after the major retailers that profit from the labor of sweatshop workers across the country. Some people think that it's the manufacturers and the owners of these little sweatshops that are responsible. But the truth is that the people that are really profiting from the sweatshop and that are acting in a way to make it necessary for there to be sweatshops are the major retailers where you buy your clothes every week.
Who are some of these companies? Who are these stores?
The big ones, Macy's, Sears, JCPenney, Walmart, Kmart, all of them really are engaged in pushing down the conditions of work and the wages of sweatshop workers in our urban centers across this land.
And when you say sweatshop workers, you're talking, these are factories totally unorganized, most of them illegal, or some of them actually legal operations that just pay either below minimum wage or at minimum wage?
Well, they're basically illegal shops because they all violate labor laws in significant ways, usually the minimum wage law, almost universally the overtime law. They don't pay overtime no matter how many hours you work, and many people work 70, 75 hours a week, 7 days a week, and they violate health and safety laws. They've got locked fire exits. We're sitting on a time bomb. There could be a triangle fire disaster, and hundreds of workers could lose their lives any day.
What are your estimates in terms of the numbers of people at this stage throughout the country that are working in sweatshops? Do you have any, or does anyone have any estimates?
The Congressional General Accounting Office has made estimates that there are close to 100,000 workers toiling in sweatshops.
Now, some of those places are right here in the New York City area. And, Danyang Feng, you organize out in Brooklyn and Sunset Park. Can you describe the places that you're going to and the workers that work there?
Yeah, actually, in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, there are about 150 shops, so-called sweatshops. Actually, you know, there are only a very few union shops in Sunset Park. The majority of shops are unionized. So a lot of shops are actually under very, very bad working conditions. The workers working in those shops, the majority of them are Asian women. And they have to work extremely long hours. For example, right now it's like a busy season. Most of the workers work 10 to 14 hours a day and 6 to 7 days a week without overtime pay. And the wage is very low. And a lot of workers actually not even make a minimum wage. And some of them, especially the older workers, they're making only a couple of cents per hour. And also there are a lot of child laborers in those sweatshops. Just like yesterday, we had an organizer in the Sunset Park shops. And she saw a boy, he's 11 years old, working in the shop. And also he told our organizer, he said he has to work until 9:30 to 10 o'clock at night. And some shop also actually put a sign outside of a shop to hire teenage students. So, and also the working conditions are really bad. A lot of shops open in the basement or garage. And in the winter, the shop's very cold because they don't have enough heat. And in the summer, the shop is extremely hot. There are no air condition. And the employer don't even let workers bring their own fan to the shops. And also there are no any kind of a protection for the workers in the, for health and safety. We had to deal with a case, a teenage girl. She actually is only 17 years old. Her eyes was injured by needles, and she almost blind. But she was very scared, and you know we tried to encourage her to make a complaint, but she refused to make a complaint. She said she was the person who violated the law. So this is like a very serious problem because a lot of workers working in those sweatshops are new immigrant workers. They don't speak English very well, and they don't have a knowledge about the law, the protection for the workers and the workers' rights.
Well, what do these companies, Macy's, Sears, and JCPenney's, when you confront them about these kinds of illegal conditions, what is their response?
Their response is that they're not responsible. They're not the employer of these workers. But more and more people are starting to realize that they are responsible, that they know exactly how much these garments cost to make, and they know exactly how much workers can be paid for making these garments. Therefore, they know they're profiting. They control the process by setting the price, by giving the designs out. They are responsible.
You know, the National Labor Committee, the research and advocacy arm of a number of unions here in the city, did this campaign against the Gap, where they went around the country and brought young women from Honduras and El Salvador up talking about the working conditions. And they succeeded in getting an agreement from the Gap around working conditions and allowing international monitors in. People really responded to this. Now, this was in another country. You guys are focusing on sweatshops in this country, and we see a lot of news reports on China, on occasionally now more on other places. We don't see them as much on this country. Is your message getting out into the media about what's happening? What is your media strategy?
Well, Unite was a part of that campaign. Our strategy is to fight sweatshops at home and abroad because it's really the same problem. You know, it's really the problem of these major retailers pushing the prices down and not caring about the conditions in the shops where these garments are made. But the American consumer does care, and our strategy is to let them know exactly what the conditions are in sweatshops at home and abroad. And I think it's beginning to take hold. I think the exposure of the El Monte, California sweatshop, where workers, Thai workers, were actually held in slavery for years at a time, got a lot of publicity and awakened the American public and the consumer to what's going on in the shops where their clothes are being made.
Well, I know, for instance, that Labor Secretary Reich has made some statements condemning the situation. But what is the Clinton administration doing in terms of being able to go after these sweatshops in a systematic way? Because if the government sends out the message that it's not going to tolerate this continued flouting of the law, I think that you've got a better chance, don't you, of eliminating the worst abuses.
Absolutely. The government certainly has a role to play, and we've been working with the Department of Labor and with Secretary Reich and with Maria Echaveste, who's head of the Wages and Hours Enforcement Division, to get better enforcement and to use the hot goods provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which says that goods that are made in violation of overtime, minimum wage, and child labor laws can be seized by the federal government, cannot be shipped in interstate commerce. And that use by the Clinton administration of that provision has advanced the cause of fighting sweatshops a great deal, and we hope that it continues and is strengthened.
Do you have any idea how many seizures have been made? Or?
Well, it's certainly several dozen, mm-hmm. I would say. And many of these are involved, these large manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And these manufacturers have been forced to sign settlement agreements with the Department of Labor, assuming responsibility for the conditions in their shops. And this is a first. This is really a very important breakthrough. And
who has done that?
The first one to do it was Guess, but several other major manufacturers have done it.
Did this come out of the protests of women standing outside the manufacturer's headquarters and embarrassing them, showing them their checks, et cetera?
Well, not only that, but also the action of the U.S. Department of Labor and the California office of the U.S. Department of Labor to go after these violators when they found that every single shop that their garments were being made in was violating the Fair Labor Standards Act.
John Yung-Fung, let me ask you something about this primary season. Immigrants are among the top issues, and immigrant bashing seems to be a favorite pastime of the candidates, whether you're talking about Republican or often Democrats as well, talking about the, quote, problem of immigrants. What does this do for people who are working in these sweatshops? Do they get more afraid?
Yes, actually, just pretty recently, we heard a lot of target from immigration, and so a lot of workers actually afraid. In a lot of shops in Sunset Park, there are document workers and non-document workers. And, you know, because of this kind of a target from, INS, a lot of workers, you know, they're more afraid. They don't want to speak out for their rights. They're afraid to be deported or, you know, they're afraid to lose their actually, you know, many people are afraid to be kicked out from the country. So that would be a ready-make the sweatshop situation worse.
Right. We're seeing actually what I consider to be a reign of terror in the New York City garment industry. The INS, it's not just that they're raiding factories. It's the way in which they're doing it. They're walking in. These are warrantless raids. They have no warrant. They're targeting Korean-owned shops in the garment district right in the next building from where we're sitting. And they're walking into these shops, threatening the owner that if they don't let them in, it will be tougher for them. And they're hauling people away. They're going through their purses and their pockets without any their permission. They're not telling people of their right to counsel. And they're taking them to jail in Pennsylvania, incommunicado, without notifying their families. Mothers whose children are in daycare, I don't know what happens to the children at night when the mother doesn't show up. And this is a very serious problem. It's taken workers' minds off of organizing to improve their conditions. And we're talking about not just illegal aliens, but also the legal residents that are working in the same shop next to the illegal aliens. They are not thinking about exercising their rights. They're thinking about protecting themselves from this reign of terror.
If people experience these kind of conditions or they know of factories where this is going on, who do they contact?
They should contact Unite.
And what is the contact number?
212-265-7000, and they should ask for the organization department.
And that's 212-265-7000 if you know about these sweatshops anywhere in the country. We want to thank our two guests, Jeff Hermanson, Director of National Organizing, and Dunyoung Fung, Director of the Campaign for Justice in Brooklyn, for joining us and helping to expose this issue. We're going to catch up with you at different points during the year and find out how the campaign is going. Well, Juan, it looks like we've come to another end of Democracy Now, and you can go back to writing your book, Latinos in America.
Yes, and get back to doing my column again. I've been on vacation finishing the book now for several weeks now.
And Juan Gonzalez is a columnist with the Daily News here in New York, where the primary is taking place. And if you'd like to comment on anything you've heard today, you can write to us at our email address, and that is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. You've been listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national grassroots election show. And if you have friends anywhere in the country that are not able to hear this, tell them to call their local community or public broadcasting station, their radio station, and ask them to run Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Bernard White with help from Dred Scott Keyes. Our director, Errol Maitland, with assistance from Sonia White. Special thanks to Paul Wunder. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Join me tomorrow for another edition of Pacifica Radio's grassroots daily election show, Democracy Now! Tomorrow, it's International Women's Day. We who believe